funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
For some U.S. immigrants, the dream of life in America is about economic opportunity. For others, the dream is as simple and profound as freedom from persecution and violence. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. The United States does grant legal residency to some who seek refuge here, but the burden of proof is on those who have come here to escape extraordinary danger elsewhere. In North Texas, thousands of asylum seekers have had help from an organization called Human Rights Initiative, which provides free legal assistance to people looking to gain permission to rebuild their lives in the United States. This fall, Human Rights Initiative of North Texas will celebrate its 15th anniversary. Joining us to talk about the work they do are HRI Executive Director William Holston and Mariam Bojong. She is the female genital mutilation survivor representative of the Global Woman Peace Foundation and a one-time client of HRI during her application for asylum from Gambia. Welcome both of you to Think.
Good afternoon.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
What is the definition of immigrant asylum, and what criteria, Bill, do applicants have to meet in order to be considered?
Well, it's a fairly straightforward definition. You have to show that you have a well-founded fear of persecution, and that you're unable or unwilling to return to your home country. But the tricky part is it has to be for five reasons: race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or a particular social group.
So that what's not on that list is gender.
That's correct.
Does that mean that people from countries that oppress women cannot apply for asylum strictly because of that?
That's correct. So the only – as you were listening to the list there, you realize gender doesn't fit in with any of the five categories: race, religion, nationality. But it does with particular social group. A particular social group is a group of people that have a characteristic. It can't be such a broad characteristic like gender, but it can be a characteristic like women that are unable to leave a marriage because of domestic violence. It could be homosexuality, or it could be, in this case, a group of women that are trying to escape female genital mutilation.
Mariam, you came to the United States to study political science. Did you know when you left Gambia that you would want to remain here?
No, not at all, because my first intention of coming to the United States was to come and have a good education and go back home and make good use of it.
And then what started to change your thinking?
It happened after my graduation from Navarro College, and then I was supposed to go back home, and then I learned that when I go back home, a second circumcision awaits me, and that was what changed the whole situation.
This is a problem that I think a lot of Americans assume exists only for women overseas, but there are, in fact, thousands of women in this country who have been affected this way.
Yes. As the rate of immigration increases, so many people that come into the country are people that have gone through FGM. And what people don't know is FGM is said to be even practiced in the United States, even though it's illegal. People are still doing it underground. And what parents also do is, like during the summer holidays, they will take their children back home, either to Africa or other countries, and have them circumcised, and then they bring them back after their summer vacation is over.
The first, you use the word circumcision, and we should be clear here, this is a more invasive procedure,
yes,
than male circumcision.
It's actually a mutilation.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
How was it explained to you when you were a child before the first procedure that you went through?
You are not even actually told it is going to happen to you. They don't tell you about it. No one discusses it. It's a taboo to actually even mention the word, not to talk of discussing it with anybody. So you are not told. You're either told you're going to visit a relative, or they wait until you're asleep, then they come and attack you and grab you and kidnap you and take you to have you mutilated.
So you didn't know this was coming?
No, I didn't know at all.
And what did your relatives, your female relatives, tell you during and after it was over?
They make it seem as if it's a rite of passage. You know, you're entering womanhood. Like, they make it seem as if with you being circumcised, you know, mutilated, you have a voice in society. Without you passing through the process, you don't have a voice in society. No one listens to you. Because even back home in the Gambia, if you're not, you know, circumcised or mutilated, I would say, people have a name for you. They call you Solima, which is actually an insult. You don't have a voice in society. no one listens to you, and it's even hard for you to have a husband at some point in time.
The thought being that the mutilation makes you purer somehow for your husband.
Pure, exactly, yes.
When did you realize that you could be angry about this?
Before I came here, I thought, you know, my parents did the right thing, like my mom and my grandmom who actually took me. I thought they did the best thing for me. So it was until that I came here, when I came here, that I learned that, you know, I was a little bit different from everyone else. This is something that was not supposed to happen to anybody. Talk less of, you know, a female child, that you have to do something like this to them. So it was when I came here, and then I learned a lot about, you know, human rights and the violations of human rights, especially female rights. And then I got to know about FGM. I did more research about it. And then I knew it was something that was wrong. But back home, they make it seem as if it is what is supposed to happen. My parents have gone through it. You know, my mom has gone through it. My aunties, my grandmom. It's something that has been in culture forever. So why would I come and then try to change it? It's something that has happened, and it's supposed to happen to you because it's something that makes you pure and clean.
So you decided you wanted to stay so that you would not have to undergo circumcision again. Is that a choice that you could have expressed in Gambia? Did you have the right to say no?
No. Like I said, it's a taboo to actually even discuss it, mm-hmm. talk less of standing in public and then, you know, telling them, no, I'm not doing it. Because me seeking asylum in the United States came with consequences that I have to cut away from my family. It came with, you know, consequences, you know, that I don't have to be in contact with my family, because if not, something might happen. Even talking about it, people still tell me, oh, you're saying too much. This is not what is supposed to be discussed in public. You know, there's a taboo. People make it seem as if you even mention the word, thunder is going to strike you or something. Mm. Yes.
That's a hard sacrifice to make, even if you feel like you're protecting yourself, to cut yourself off from your family.
Yes. Well, I see it as if everything in life comes with a sacrifice, and things happen for a reason. I feel like I was chosen to be the voice for people that do not have the the opportunity or even the experience to stand here and tell their story. So I feel like I was chosen to be that voice for them and let the world know what is happening.
How did you find your way to HRI?
It was actually through the help of my school and our international student coordinator called Angie Copeland, who did the research and found out about HRI. And then she was the one that actually contacted them on my behalf.
Bill, do you remember when this case first came across your desk?
I do, actually. And this was unusual, but they called all of our phone numbers are on our website. So she called my phone line directly and explained Miriam's situation. And I said, well, this is certainly the kind of case we handle, and she needs to come in and meet with our lawyers. And that's our process. We have a pretty exacting intake process, and they go through at least any potential client goes through two different interviews with lawyers. And I think I did the second interview with Miriam.
Yes, you did.
And so then what happens is we do about a two-hour interview where we go into real detail with the client's story, and then we meet as all the lawyers and legal staff meet, and they discuss, actually debate the cases, probe inconsistencies. We have to be satisfied that the client's credible and telling the truth. And then they come in for a second interview with a separate lawyer and another staff member, and then we sit down again, and then we decide to take the case and then place those with a pro bono lawyer.
And the ones that you choose not to take, that's because you don't think they'll be successful?
No, we're actually really careful not to put it that way, because we want to take clients and not have in mind whether we're going to win or not. But it really has to pass two tests. One is the people are telling the truth. So if we don't believe the people are telling the truth, then we don't take their case. And the other one is if they're telling the truth, that we think they're legally entitled to relief. Because there's a lot of people who have really sad stories because they're coming from bad places and bad things have happened to them, but they don't qualify for asylum. And so we have to believe in the case technically under the law.
Did you prepare, Mariam, before that first call? Did you know what they would ask you about?
No, I didn't prepare at all because, like I said, it came as a surprise to me because I was on my way preparing to go back home to renew my visa and come back to school. So it all happened all of a sudden. So, but like he said, if your story is consistent and you're telling the truth, you wouldn't have a problem proving your case.
It's not necessarily easy to have perfect strangers asking you, and here I'm doing the same thing, intimate details about some of the most painful things in your life.
It's true, because looking back at where I started, and Bill will attest to that, because it was really difficult for me to even tell people what has happened to me. But again, through the help of my school, they took me through counseling and, you know, therapy. And thanks to them and HRI, I am able to stand anywhere today and tell people what is happening.
Bill, other than you, everyone who works with HRI as an attorney is a volunteer. Is that correct?
We have we have 11 employees, and five of them are lawyers. But the people that actually do the legal work are pro bono lawyers, and they're all volunteers. So we have a pretty small budget, and we stretch that budget a lot because of working with volunteer attorneys. And most of our – I would say most of our lawyers are lawyers that are affiliated with large law firms. Miriam's lawyer happened to be a sole practitioner.
Yes.
I was in a small law firm when I was volunteering for them. So we have a few, but it's all free legal services by lawyers that are doing this because – well, because they're motivated to do the right thing.
Yeah, what does it take to most lawyers that I know are pretty busy with the jobs that they use to earn a living. What does it take to figure out who would be right to do this kind of pro bono work and to make sure that people's skills are matched up with the very difficult challenges that you're going to present them with?
Well, I'd say, first of all, it's, you know, there's this adage, if you want to get something done, you ask somebody who's busy. You know, lawyers... Many lawyers live by the billable hour, and so their time is quite dear. But here's what I'd say. Most of us went to law school, and we had the idea that we might help people with that law degree, and you really wind up not having that opportunity in general. You're representing businesses. You like those clients, but it's all about mostly about money, mm-hmm. and that's not very soul satisfying. And so the client, so our lawyers, the people who volunteer for us, are people that feel sometimes they want to just get some courtroom experience when they have a practical reason for wanting to take a case. But what they find is that the work is so fulfilling, and that it satisfies that part of them that really made them go to law school to begin with, and then they come back. And so most of our lawyers are repeat lawyers because they find the work so satisfying. And the other thing that's interesting about that is almost none of our volunteers are immigration lawyers. They're mm-hmm. bankruptcy lawyers, merger and acquisition lawyers, family lawyers. And so they're not familiar with the law. And so it takes a lot of commitment on their part to learn the law, learn the procedures to be effective.
You got hooked after you did. I gather you thought you'd try one pro bono case and see how it went.
Yeah, I remember it really well. Marta was a young woman from Guatemala. This was in the late 1980s. Her husband had been a labor leader in a trucker's union. They were taking their kids to school one morning, and an unmarked car pulled up, grabbed her husband, and took him. And then 2 days later, she was told to come and identify as Mahdi in the morgue. Mm-hmm. And he had been murdered by a death squad. And then they started threatening her and her children, and she made the really difficult decision to come to the United States. So I helped her in her affirmative application for asylum, and it was just so fulfilling. And so I did. It was a really simple decision on my part. I just said, well, I'll keep one of these cases going all the time, and I did that for the next 20 years.
We're speaking this hour with William Holston, who is Executive Director of Human Rights Initiative of North Texas, and with Mariam Bochang. She is an FGM survivor representative of the Global Woman Peace Foundation and a one-time client of HRI. We're talking about political and religious asylum in the United States in honor of the 15th anniversary of Human Rights Initiative of North Texas. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about asylum in the United States in honor of the 15th anniversary of Human Rights Initiative of North Texas. Joining us for the conversation are the organization's executive director, William Holston, and a client, Mariam Bojang. She's FGM survivor representative of the Global Woman Peace Foundation. If you would like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Bill, how often are the clients who ultimately make their way to HRI reluctant to even bring themselves to the attention of government in the United States when they have had real struggles in the places they came from?
Well, I think that where you see that manifest is it how long it might take them to make the decision to apply for asylum. They don't just leap to that decision. It sometimes takes a long time, and that creates a real hardship because the law changed a few years ago. You have to apply within 1 year of entering the United States, and if you don't, then you're not going to get asylum. You might get something called withholding of deportation, which is you don't have to go back, but you're not in line for a green card and you can't bring your family over. So it's actually creates a lot of hardships. But I've heard these stories a lot over the years, and people struggle with it a long time. And usually what happens is they're pushed into that decision by some piece of news from home that, you know, soldiers, if these are political activists, soldiers have been to their home and asking about them, or a family member that they left behind has been threatened or harmed by the military or police. And then they say, well, I came here. I didn't really intend to stay, but there's no going back.
Mariam, I don't know if you have sisters or cousins or friends back in Gambia that after you made the decision to apply for asylum, did you start to think, I want to bring other people over here and protect them?
Yes, because I remember during my asylum process, I actually spoke to my mom and she had just told me that, oh, your cousin, she is going to be circumcised. And I felt like, oh, if only I had a way to bring her here and protect her from that. I was really sad because I thought, okay, my case has not been approved, but then still I want to reach out to her and then ask her to either run away or do something. Because still now, like, I have friends that call me and tell me, like, the complications that they have been having in their personal life or their marital homes. And I feel so sad that, okay, if I had this opportunity to help them and, get them over here and do something for them, it will at least help them out or something.
At what point did you start thinking of yourself as an activist?
I would say it started when I started doing the interviews and started talking to people more about what FGM is. The first time it hit me was when I would sit, in a group of people, and then, I would say FGM, and people would look at me like, what is FGM? And then I'll start explaining to them. And before you know what's happening, I have the whole crowd crying or shedding tears, and I'll be like, it's fine, you don't have to cry about it. But they tell me, no, we knew nothing about this before. So I'm like, okay, I really have to start speaking out and let people know, because it's something that happens in a lot of places, and it's so unfortunate that people don't hear about it or they don't know about FGM.
Do you think that if the taboos against talking about it were lifted, that more mothers and grandmothers would say, I'm not going to do to my daughter what was done to me?
I think it has to take more than just stopping it as a taboo. I think it has to take a lot of sensitization, and then because when the process is being done, it's done in an unhealthy environment. It's done at home, probably in a backyard, in a toilet or something. And the equipments that are being used are rusted and old. The same equipment that is used on me is the same that is used on every other girl. They are not sanitized. And just talking about that, it's going to change a lot because people don't know the consequences that happen after FGM. It has a lot of complications, like health complications that come with it. And these health complications stay with you for the rest of your life. And this is what people need to know about it.
As do the emotional complications,
yes.
Really.
Yes.
These are personal questions, but do you date now, or have you Have you explored romantic relationships?
Well, I recently got engaged, but here it's termed as an engagement, but back home it's termed as a marriage because mm-hmm. we don't do proposals. You tell your intentions and they tie the knot between. So back home it's seen as a marriage, but here it is an engagement.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Bill, you also have worked a lot, and you guys were very busy in the last year with this wave of unescorted minors from Latin America. A lot of people heard these stories, and they didn't really understand what was happening, and a lot of people looked at this with great suspicion. Tell us what you've learned about the motivations for people to send their children across sometimes multiple borders to the relative safety of the U.S.
So last year, about 68,000 unaccompanied minors came into the United States, and that's in addition to the minors that traveled across the border with a parent. These were kids primarily from El Salvador and Honduras, and also Guatemala. And so all of those kids were crossing multiple borders to get to the United States. We heard similar stories often, and it was something akin to this. This was a kid, usually 14, 15 years old, going to school, involved in a church group. And then those were the very kids that were getting targeted by these really violent gangs that the police have really no control over. And so as the kids started getting more and more threats against their life, and sometimes not just threats, you know, the little girls would be threatened with sexual assault. The boys sometimes were assaulted. We had a young man whose throat was slit. Just really terrible things were happening to these kids. And then the kids would be living with grandparents, and they had a parent up here in the United States working, and maybe the other parent was completely missing, in jail, dead, something like that. So it's the grandparents a lot of times who made the decision. Look, I'm old.
I can't get you there, but
I can't get
go.
You there, and we'll hire somebody to take you to the United States because it's just not safe for you here anymore. And we heard really little kids talking about what it was like in Honduras. You know, Honduras was the murder capital of the world last year. San Pedro Sula was the most violent city in the world. And we had kids talking about, look, we heard gunfire all night. We quit going to school because every time we went to school, the gangs would get us for money, and they would go and tell my parents that they were going to kill them if they didn't give them money. And life just became untenable for them. Now, we also talked to kids that came up here because they thought there were economic reasons. They thought they'd have a better life here in the United States, and those kids don't have any kind of legal remedy.
What does documentation look like for a 12-year-old who's been threatened by a street gang? This is not necessarily the sort of thing that shows up, as you mentioned, in police records because the police have no control.
There really is no documentation. Sometimes kids if they'd actually been assaulted, they'd have a medical record or something that showed that. And, of course, some of them had actually injuries and things that demonstrated the injuries. But most of the cases were based upon the personal testimonies of the children and their family. And it's just like any other court. I mean, just like any other case in court, people tell their stories. And if they're not able to tell them in a consistent, coherent way, they're not believable. But if they can, they are.
How do you prepare clients to go before the court and give testimony?
Well, it's a very, very time-consuming process. And remember, of course, often you're dealing with a translator. So that presents difficulties just not only with the amount of time it takes, but also sometimes you struggle with the quality of your translator. And so, you know, things get, quote, lost in translation, and that takes time. I'd say that the initial thing that's so difficult is to establish rapport with the client, like Miriam alluded to earlier. It's not easy to talk about sexual assault or torture or things that have happened to you. They're very intimate and terrible memories. And so nobody wants to just sit down and tell this lawyer their story. And it takes a long time to establish enough of a relationship and rapport and confidence with a person will go into detail. Because what happens is, and I usually apologize to clients and say, look, I'm sorry. I have to ask you really terrible things about your life. And not only that, I have to ask you to talk about them in great detail, because the only way you're going to be successful in court is to tell your story in detail that's subject to cross-examination. And I'm sorry for that, but you're not going to win your case if we don't do that. And it's one of the reasons it's so special that Miriam's willing to talk about her story, because many of our asylum clients, when they're done, they're done. They don't ever want to talk about these things again.
Miriam, how did you make the choice that you would keep talking about this?
Like I said earlier, I saw that it helped a lot of people, and just not in the United States, but also I had friends calling me or texting me from back home telling me, you know, you're doing a great job, you know, let them know what is going on, let them hear what is happening to us, because to us here we think it's okay, but then here people don't even know about it. There it's normal for you to just sleep one night and be kidnapped and then taken. So, but here people don't actually even hear about it. So I'm like, this is something that needs to be told. This is something that people need to hear about, because it's a form of kidnapping if you look at it. It's not only kidnapping, but also it's a violation of your right, because you're taking without your own consent. You don't even know it's going to happen to you.
So when you arrived in the United States, you were in your late teens, early 20s?
Yes,
okay.
Late teens.
Was there a point at which you suddenly realized, oh, not every woman in this classroom that I'm sitting in has gone through this?
Yes, I think that was the point where I knew that my rights were violated, because I would talk about, you know, certain things, not go in depth in it, because I was like, oh, it's a taboo to even talk about it. Something is going to happen to me. But then people will tell me, what are you talking about? You know, they wouldn't even know what I'm talking about. And then I knew that, oh, I'm a little bit different from these people. Back home, it's like I was part of everyone else. But here it's like I'm an outsider because of that. So that made me question a lot of things that people said, oh, it's why we did FGM. Because so some of the things that they said were the reasons why FGM was performed, it's baseless if you look at it, because they said, oh, it lessens teenage pregnancy, but really it lessens your urge for sex, and in the end you're not even able to satisfy your husband because there's nothing left there. But if people ask me, oh, why do you think they do it, I say, to me it's all because of male dominance if you look at it, because back then people were allowed to have up to 10 wives before Islam came. And when Islam came, it allowed a man to have up to 4 wives. And I tell people, no one can satisfy 4 wives in a week. So obviously FGM was done to lessen the woman's urge for sex, you know, to profit the man.
Bill, have you and your colleagues, you mentioned that it is hard to, you know, many of your clients are not as forthcoming as Mariam, struggle more to recount these violences across the board. Is there a process by which you've learned? You said you need to make people comfortable with you. Do you know that on the first visit, there's only so much you can cover, and then you, you know, break for a iced tea? How do you work so that you can get to know these clients and get them to trust you, and also get to the long work of preparing these cases?
Well, let's say, first of all, you know, we make effort. As I remember, we were shorthanded the summer that you came to us, which was why I was actually doing the interview. I don't normally do those personally. We would normally have had Miriam talk to a female attorney. And so that in itself. And I remember when I think I did your second intake, and we didn't go into the detail of the procedures. I mean, there was no reason for me to make you talk about those things, so we didn't. And then you just take your time. You have to be really patient. I don't know if our other pro bonos did this, but when I was in private practice, I usually talked a little bit about myself. I'd tell my clients, I'd show them pictures of my children. I'd talk about me, why I did this work, because I wanted them it was a shared experience. I wanted them to, I wasn't just asking them to share themselves with me, but I was showing a little bit of myself to them. And then when I have the opportunity to talk to pro bonos, that's what I tell them. Just take your time. And it was, you know, the flip side of this is the best part of the work. I loved getting to know my clients. And it was a privilege, because we're often dealing with very brave people. And it's very inspiring to spend time with them.
Do you think that the level of scrutiny that these cases receive in immigration courts is appropriate? Do you think it should be less?
Well, I think they should be. I think any asylum seeker should be subject to a legal process, and it should be an adversarial process. They should be subject to cross-examination. The process, I guess I'll answer it another way, which is there's a wide variance in experience between courts in different parts of the United States. And there's a big difference between different judges and how they approach these cases. And on occasion, the judges act, you're not just facing the government lawyer, you're facing the judge who's also subjecting your client. Sometimes a really, really difficult questions, but skeptical questions. And so I'd say that the process is not as objective as it really should be. But it should. But I welcome scrutiny. I mean, we don't want asylum seekers that are gaming the system and liars, you know. So there needs to be some way to ferret those cases out. But it needs to be done in a fair and even-handed way.
Once someone has been granted asylum, are they positioned to eventually apply for U.S. citizenship?
Yeah, in position to get a green card and citizenship. And that's a great thing about having been around for 15 years. We're now seeing our clients become citizens, you know, join the military, have families here, pursue their educations. And now we're seeing the long-term impact of what it meant. I just got together with a client for the first time in about 12 years the other day. Hmm. And he was a Christian from Pakistan, and he now has two American citizen children, has been an executive in a corporation for the last few years, has a home, is an American citizen, doing really well, and loves this country.
We're speaking this hour with William Holston, who's executive director of Human Rights Initiative of North Texas, which is celebrating its 15th anniversary this year. Also with us is Mariam Bojong, an FGM survivor representative of the Global Woman Peace Foundation and a one-time client of HRI during her application for asylum from Gambia. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Speaking this hour with Mariam Bojong, FGM survivor representative of the Global Woman Peace Foundation and a one-time client of Human Rights Initiative, and William Holston, who is executive director of Human Rights Initiative of North Texas, celebrating its 15th anniversary this year. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 800-933-5372. Has the tide of anti-immigration sentiment affected your ability to serve clients at all, Bill?
I think in general, no. We saw that really illustrated in the unaccompanied minor crisis. We had a lot of new volunteers, people that contacted us who had never volunteered in the past. There was something about the children that touched their heart. Then the other thing is, wherever you fall in your views on of economic immigrants, it's an entirely different thing to say that you're anti someone fleeing violence, someone fleeing torture because they're a pro-democracy activist. I would say we have an awful lot of very conservative supporters and a lot of conservative volunteers. They're people that might not even have progressive ideas generally about immigration, but they understand that America should continue to be a place of refuge for people fleeing persecution.
How are the success stories tracked? You mentioned you have people now occasionally coming back. Do they write? Do they email? Do they jump on the Facebook page and say, here's how I'm doing?
It's, we're a small staff, and so we really don't have processes for tracking that. It's very anecdotal and just based upon our own. I mean, I reached out to that client just because I was curious about how he was doing. And I think that's more or less how that happens. We do have some clients that come back and say, I want to give back and want to volunteer. They become financial donors. I think we're actually getting better in the last few years about taking advantage of people like Miriam and other clients and ask them. There's a real reluctance on our part to ask our clients for things. They've been through so much and they feel such a huge sense of gratitude to us. So we don't want to exploit that. And so we're kind of reluctant about it, honestly. But we're getting a little bolder about just asking and making it real clear. But if you want to do it, that's okay.
Mariam, in your activism, do you find it's most effective to target women? Do you also make a point of trying to inform men about the violence being perpetrated on women?
Yes. Most of the people that we target are women, but we also target men because if you look at it, it's the fathers that can stop this actually, because in most cases, especially in African households, if the man says no, is what stands. So, but if you look at FGM, it's like the fathers don't know anything about it. It's all the mothers, the aunties, the grandmothers. But if you target the dads and the uncles and the brothers, it's like they are the ones that can actually put a stop to it because their word is what is going to stand in the household. So right now we are trying to target the men in particular.
And how does it work being half a world away from the people you're trying to protect?
It's easy and at the same time not easy, but thanks to technology, you can call back home and talk to someone, or you can organize a seminar and send money and fund it, and people are home that will, you know, take care of everything and make sure it is a success. Because we have done a couple of sensitizations and, you know, workshops, advocacy workshops that are taking place back home. And thankfully enough, there are people that are coming out and voluntarily, you know, saying that, okay, fine, I inherited this practice from my ancestors and now I'm letting it go. So what people do back home is you help them start a small-scale business because FGM is what they depended on. People give them money if they practice it. So if they leave that, so now what are they going to hold on to? So they take a loan or probably you fund them. And then once they get a small-scale business set up, and then, you know, they'll repay you back your money, and then they'll have a livelihood that they can bank on.
Bill, what's the process for asylum seekers who have families back home that would like to be reunited with them?
They, as soon as they're granted asylum, they're able to technically petition for their family members to come over here. But as a practical matter, that can take an awfully long time. For one thing, they need to get established themselves financially, particularly if there's somebody who wasn't able to or wasn't permitted to work while their case was pending. They have to get a job. They have to raise money. Of course, they're coming from Africa. The plane fares are really expensive. They don't... you know, they've been completely on their own and so financially, and so sometimes that's a year and a half, 2 years while their case is pending, and so it just is difficult for them to get on their feet financially enough to be able to bring a wife and children here. And then there are practical issues. Sometimes they're coming from places that are, you know, of course, often from very oppressive places. They have to be careful. They have to have contacts at airports and maybe. That involves a bribery of trying to get their family members out of the country. Sometimes they have to take them to other countries so that they can safely transit to the United States. So it takes a long time. But we see it. First things that happened after I took this job here, I ran into one of my clients from Ethiopia whose family had been back there while his case was pending, and they were all here in my office working on work authorizations.
It's not really a legal question, but it has to be a strain on a relationship to be separated for all that time and then also have the pressures of moving and sort of uprooting an entire family.
It's very, very, to say difficult, I just can't think of a better word than that. It's heart-wrenching, honestly. We had a client who, you know, was forced. He was arrested and tortured. He was forced to leave his pregnant wife behind, and his child was born back in Africa, and he met his two-year-old child for the first time at DFW Airport. Mm. It was a very joyous occasion. And there's sometimes guilt with people that they were forced by circumstances to leave family behind, but often it's they were able to come up with enough money for one person to leave, and it's the person who was escaping a torture cell. But it does put – I'm sure it puts real strains on marriages and, you know, children that didn't know their father and they have to reunite. It's daunting. And, you know, America's a difficult – it's not for the faint of heart. And there's a lot of opportunity here. It's a great country. But you're kind of – you've got to make your own way here. And that's hard.
Anything you want to respond to there, Maureen?
Adding to what he said, you asked if it's, you know, it is a difficult process because having to leave your life, everything there. And like I said, I didn't plan on, you know, staying here. My plan was to come, get the education, and then, you know, go back home and have a good job. And then, but then having to leave all that back home, your family, your friends, and start everything new here, especially if you don't know anyone here, it's a really difficult process because then you have to start all over again. The cultures are different. People are different. The way they do things here is different. So just to adapt to that, it's also a difficult process, not to talk of then having to settle down and having to bring back your family here who would also have to start fresh. It is a really difficult process.
Was there a moment where you thought, oh, I'm doing this like an American?
Yes. There are several moments when, especially when I say y'all, yeah, I'm like, oh. Yeah.
Yeah. Bill, this sounds like a crass question, but what is the cash value of all these pro bono legal services over the course of a typical year at HRI?
Yeah, it's not a crass question at all. We're really proud of the fact that we just completed our audit, so we don't have the final numbers. So, but last year it was over $3 million worth of free legal services for our clients. And the year before that it was about $4 million.
And if you were to charge these clients even reduced rates, what percentage of them would even be able to pay?
None.
Yeah.
All of our clients are below poverty guidelines, and often way, way, way below poverty guidelines. There are a limited number of people who come here to the United States with some means that are able to hire lawyers in the private bar, but they're not getting, they struggle mightily to pay legal fees. And I don't know that any asylum seeker would really be able to pay for the amount of work that we put into these asylum cases.
And do they have to have a foot on the ground here before they can initiate a case?
Yes.
Yeah. They have to be legally in the country?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, we have. It depends on we have a lot of clients who come here under visas. People like Miriam came here as a student. We also have clients that it's virtually impossible for somebody from Eritrea to come here legally. And so they go through really long and exhausting smuggling routes to get here to the United States.
What is the possibility, Mariam, to try to tell other people back in Gambia who are in your situation what opportunities there might be for them to be safe elsewhere? And how do you spread that message? You said you talk to people on the phone and you call and text. Are there underground publications that are trying to serve women and educate women?
There are, because I have a friend who actually has set up an organization, and she is doing a wonderful job. She goes back home frequently to make these sensitization conferences and seminars, and she's doing a great job. And also what the Global Women Peace Foundation is trying to do is they're trying to do a fundraising where they'll sponsor at least two or three people a year and then have them come here and do reconstruction surgeries, you know. So, and that also is helping because people know that if this is where it leads me to, then it must be something that is not good because having to go back to do a reconstruction surgery and then all those stuff. It takes a lot of process and a lot of money. So with the help of technology, like I said, you can Skype and be here and then talk to someone, you know, back home, because I'll have friends that will come around, sit, you know, in front of a laptop, and I will talk to them. And then, you know, some of them will hide and then, you know, talk to me about it or email me or send me a text and then ask me to call them because they need to talk to me. So I'll call them back home and then they will tell me the problems that they've been having, the complications, and ask me if I can help out or know anyone who can help them out. So in most times, I do send some stuff back home, like medicines to help with constant abdominal pains that people have and all the illnesses also due to FGM.
Bill, how has HRI changed in 15 years and evolved? If it has.
No, I think it has. You know, of course, 15 years ago, nobody had heard of us. I think we've made a lot of progress in getting our name out there in the community. We have 15 years worth of progress in building relationships with the law firms here in the city. We now have an excellent reputation. We have an excellent reputation with the courts, with the Office of Chief Counsel here, who are our opponents in court, with the law firms, institutions, schools. We have great reputations with the law schools, SMU and University of North Texas. We both get interns from those schools. We've had a growing relationship with corporate legal departments. AT&T is one of our the corporate legal departments are really growing in their enthusiasm for pro bono. And that's an example of a corporation who really puts a lot of man hours into actually taking pro bono cases. We have a lot of experience under our belt with how to do this better. I think we do it better than we did when I first started doing these cases 15 years ago. So I guess when you ask me, I think a lot has changed. And then there are things that haven't changed. You know, it's just as satisfying now as it was 20 years ago when I first started doing asylum cases.
If there's anything you could do to dispel the myths that people hold about the process, what are the things that people, Americans, tend to misunderstand?
Well, I think people in general think that this is an easy process and that anybody can just claim asylum here in the United States, and that is just utter fiction. This is a very, very daunting and difficult process to go through, and our government puts people through the ringer in trying to prove their cases. And I hear this, people say, oh, it's just rent with fraud, and people take advantage of the system, and that just has not been my experience, and I've seen a lot of it.
William Halston is Executive Director of Human Rights Initiative of North Texas. Mariam Bojong is FGM Survivor Representative of the Global Woman Peace Foundation and a one-time client of HRI. You can learn more about the organization at hrionline.org. Thanks so much to both of you for being here. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's a genuine pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.